Talofa lava, this is Pacific Waves from RNZ Pacific. I'm Susanna Suisuiki. Coming up, a nationwide politics survey is underway in Solomon Islands. Also,
I don't know where we're heading as a country, seriously. There's no respect for rule of law and...
Gun violence continues to plague Papua New Guinea and...
One of the things that struggled was feelings of unworthiness and inadequacy.
Mangere Arts Centre packs out for the premiere of Cook Islands documentary. The Solomon Islands National University and the Australian National University are conducting a nationwide survey of politics in Solomon Islands in and around the election on Wednesday. They are one of the multiple observer groups in the country, including from the Melanesian Spearhead Group and the Pacific Islands Forum, but none of them have as many people in field for as long as the university collaboration. Kuroi Hawkins spoke with the team leader of the ANU-SINU Election Observer Group, James Batley, who has historical connections to the country, having previously served as one of the heads of the Australian-led Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands.
That's right. The two universities are mounting really quite an extensive observation exercise. We've got teams in 15 different constituencies right around the country, or in most parts of the country, and our teams will be in the field for up to 3 weeks. So we'll, of course, we'll be observing the conduct of the election on election day itself, but in the week before the election and the week after the election, the teams will be conducting surveys of Solomon Island citizens just to gauge their attitudes on a range of issues related to the elections, of course, but also politics in general. So we're using this with the ANU and Solomon Islands National University colleagues as a way of conducting research into attitudes across the country. We did a similar thing in 2019, so we're excited this time that when we get our results in and we're able to analyse them, we'll be able to see the trends between 5 years ago and now, and whether people's views are evolving, what their perceptions are. That will involve a lot of work and a lot of analysis because we collect an enormous amount of data. I think we will probably do a survey of around 5,000 Solomon Islanders in the time our teams are in the field. So it's a very big sample, and it will be very helpful, I hope, to the electoral authorities here in Solomons, and we've discussed that with them, and also to the university here. It really helps Solomon Islands academics get into the field and do some really good research, and they're very happy about that as well.
Are there some key findings from the last survey that you that stood out for you that you remember?
Well, certainly last time we had found that the election was technically run very professionally. We didn't detect any serious problems with the conduct of the election on the day itself. Most people, there was no real violence. The people who lined up to vote, it was very orderly and relaxed. We noted in our last report a phenomenon of voters moving from one area to register in a different constituency. And we did some analysis about why people might do that. And so that's something we'll be looking at again this time around. Again in 2019... a lot of Solomon Islanders talk to us about the relationship that they have with their members of parliament and the role that constituency development funds play in that relationship. So, again, that's something else that that we'll be looking out for. We ask questions about people's attitudes to women in politics, whether there should be more female members of parliament, and a range of other questions.
With the RCDF, or the whatever the new acronym is now, with Beijing, a big portion of it is development budget funding, right? It's only a component that is actually foreign funded, but it seems the narrative that I keep hearing around the here and around the place is that, you know, China funding this, that was formerly funded by Taiwan, but it's actually a big chunk of the development budget of the country, right?
Yeah, most of the funding for constituency funds comes from Solomon Islands' own sources. That's up to 75-80%. So the funding that Taiwan used to provide and the funding that China is providing now is really only a small proportion of the overall funding for constituency funds, and it's a point to remember. Yeah.
For this particular election, obviously the first joint one, anything apart from that that's different? There's been a few electoral amendments as well, other than the joint election. Anything noticeably different for you?
I don't think so. It's interesting that the joint election is being held. Obviously, that's part of what observers will be looking at. I understand that the votes for the provincial elections and the Honiara City Council will be counted before the national elections. So that will keep everyone on tenterhooks who's waiting to see the outcome of the national elections. But of course, that will happen in due course. And I can't talk about that in advance. We'll have to wait and see how all that counting goes on the day.
There's political frustration as gun violence continues to plague Papua New Guinea. It's prompted the Papua New Guinea government, the UN and EU to organise a conference to evaluate and discuss the problem. Scott Waire and Fina Funua reports.
That's the sound of gunmen who massacred 60 people in an armed ambush. The incident occurred in February in the district of Wapenamanda in Enga province, where a tribal conflict has been raging for years. The shocking tragedy has increased domestic and international pressure on Papua New Guinea's government to urgently address gun violence in the country. On Monday, the UN organized a conference bringing together experts from the EU, the UN, the PNG Defense Force to discuss the proliferation of firearms. RNZ Pacific correspondent in Papua New Guinea, Scott Waide, says the goal of the conference is to formulate a policy that would address PNG's gun crisis.
The idea is to develop a strategy to control the widespread use of rifles, guns and pistols and all that in the communities. And hopefully by the end of the 3 days, there'll be some sort of strategy document or a draft in place that they will take to government.
Among the officials in attendance is Papua New Guinea's Law and Order Parliamentary Committee Chair and Koroba Kopiago MP William Bando. Mr. Bando, who is a victim of gun violence himself, wants the government to act promptly to curb gun violence and says the situation is dire.
I don't know where we're heading as a country, seriously. There's no respect for rule of law, and who should be the ones equipped with firearms? Aren't the security forces? Or are we going to allow civilians to be carrying firearms and the security forces walking around side by side, both armed? What kind of country have we become?
Former Papua New Guinea Defense Force Commander Jerry Singerock says the country is dragging its feet on addressing the country's gun problems. Singerock, who offered a gun control report in 2005, calls for tougher gun regulations. He wants to ban the public from owning guns. He told RNZ Pacific the reforms proposed by the reports are yet to be tabled in Parliament.
There's absolutely no political will. I have had conversations with the late Grand Chief Peter O'Neill. I've made reference to the current Prime Minister and the last government, this government, and there has been no response. There's no ownership of the gun issue. The country is bleeding. The country is struggling.
William Bando supports Singerock's report and backs calls to ban gun ownership. Bando has in the past called on the public to surrender firearms.
2005, Jerry Singerock, Major General, put an extensive report on that. And if you read through it, It's only for our government to implement a lot of those recommendations, which will help help our police implement the removal of small arms and firearms throughout Papua New Guinea. We need to make a decision. We need to get an outcome and not talk about it anymore.
According to the Global Organized Crime Index, Papua New Guinea has the second highest crime rates as of 2024. The highest is Venezuela.
An academic says the New Zealand aid program has significantly improved its transparency. New Zealand's Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade has launched a new development data website, allowing the public to view almost all of the country's aid programs. Academic Terence Wood spoke to Caleb Fotheringham about the change and where it could improve.
About a month ago, MFAT put a new development data website up online, and that's a data that allows people in New Zealand to have a look at all or almost all of the different aid projects that the New Zealand aid program runs.
Okay, so did MFAT not do this before?
No, previously the information available if you went to MFAT's website was very basic. It was often out of date too, and wasn't much of a guide in terms of letting people know what New Zealand was doing by the way of its foreign aid.
Before, was there any way for people to be able to find out what New Zealand was doing with its foreign aid?
You could buy a very roundabout route, and that was about a year or more after the fact. You could go to an OECD website, and if you knew how to use that website, you could get quite detailed information on our aid spending, although it was in US dollar figures. And like I said, it was only released quite some time after the financial year in question had ended.
So with this new website, how much does it break down the aid spending? Is it pretty generic, just telling you the country and what they're doing in a roundabout way, or is it quite specific?
So no, you can go, if you click down to one of the countries, you can go and you can actually get a list of all the projects that are run in that country. And if you look at any of those projects, you can actually click on the individual projects and get a reasonable amount of information on the project. It's not everything you might want to know. It's not really any, there's no information about how successful the project has been or the like, but nevertheless, it gives you a pretty good idea of what each of the individual projects is trying to do in any particular country.
Could the website be any better?
Yeah, so the big problem with the website is actually not so much the detailed data, but the high-level data. Ideally, what you'd want a website like this to do is to provide you with numbers on how much aid we've spent in each individual previous financial year, how much we anticipate we'll spend this financial year, how much we're budgeting on spending next financial year and maybe the following two financial years. So that's sort of high-level information which would enable you to get a good sense of trends in overall New Zealand aid over time is missing. There's an attempt to provide you with some of that information, but it just gives you numbers from last financial year and then compares them with the previous five financial years in one great big lump sum. So that's sort of no use whatsoever if you're trying to track trends, high-level trends in New Zealand aid.
With New Zealand aid, when you compare it to the rest of the world, what are we like? Do we give our fair share?
No, the short answer to that question is no. We're not a particularly generous donor. If you look at the standard metric of aid generosity, which is aid as a share of gross national income, we fall. Well, we're not as bad as Australia, but we're in the bottom half of the league table. We're not nearly as generous as some Northern European donors in particular. So things, I guess, could be worse, but they could also be better. We could be quite a lot more generous. And it's probably worth reminding your listeners that in New Zealand aid as a share of total government spending is less than 1% or almost 1% of total government spending. So it's not like we make a huge sacrifice. Only 1 cent in every dollar of New Zealand government spending goes as foreign aid at present anyhow.
Do you think with a website like this, New Zealand could be put under pressure a little bit to give more, because more people will be able to understand and see the information?
To be honest, I think that that will only really happen if you have a concerted campaign by civil society designed to educate the New Zealand public about just how little aid to give. This website's certainly useful for people both in New Zealand and in the countries where aid goes to. If they want to find out sort of details on specific projects, that's what it's great for. It's a real step forward in transparency. But if you're trying to sort of mobilise public action here in New Zealand to prompt the government to be more generous, I think you need to take some numbers and then put them into a bit of a narrative format, trying to find a way of persuading people. And you won't, you know, you won't persuade people with detailed data on a website.
Now, last week on our show, we featured New FM host and filmmaker Chelsea Cuthers-Munro, who spoke about her documentary, The Waka That Waited. Well, on Friday night, the film finally made its debut at the Mangere Arts Centre, where the Cook Islands community turned up in droves. Tiana Haxton was there and has the story.
Chelsea Cuthers-Munro was subjected to backlash and harsh online comments in response to a cultural piece in 2019, leading her to vow she would never do anything cultural again. However, she decided to push through and reclaim her cultural identity. She spent 3 years exploring her heritage and admits it was a difficult journey.
One of the things I struggled with was feelings of unworthiness and inadequacy. And so halfway through this documentary, there are a lot of voices that were still quite discouraging, and I had dropped it about 2 years ago, and I said, you know, I don't want to finish it. I'm not worthy to be the one to carry this story.
Once she overcame these feelings, Chelsea sees the journey became the most healing experience of her life. She was filled with emotions and pride as she presented her documentary, The Waka That Waited, to a packed audience.
This, to me, is such a pivotal moment. If you had told me a couple of years ago that I'd be here and I'd be filled with a room of Cook Islanders, and to be able to say that I belong and I know I'm meant to be here, I'm part of this, I wouldn't have believed it back then.
As the end credits rolled, she received a standing ovation from the audience. Amongst them was the former Minister for Pacific Peoples, Aupito Williams Sio. Aupito praised Cuthers-Munro for her bravery to share her story of disconnect from her culture as a New Zealand-born Cook Islander.
We need these stories. We need these stories to remind the generation of Aotearoa New Zealand where you come from, your roots, the experiences that are captured in the old sayings.
His comments were echoed by many of the Cook Islanders in attendance, young and old. Chelsea Cuthers-Munro is currently planning on returning to Rarotonga to share her documentary with the local community.
That's Pacific Waves for today. To listen back, head over to rnzi.com/programs. We're also on Spotify, Apple and iHeartRadio. From myself and the RNZ Pacific team, till fa soifua.